Hey gang, back in the early days of summer, I interviewed my colleague from both the Hockey News and Yahoo Sports, Ian Kennedy. Ian is also the author of a book entitled On Account of Darkness, Shining Light on Race and Sport. You can find his book at retailers including Indigo and Chapters. We had a great chat discussing the history of sport in Canada, race, sports culture, and so much more. Without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy. Yo, yo, yo. What is up? What is up? What is up? Welcome back to Avery Sports Show here on a lovely May afternoon. Avery Lewis McDougall here, and I am joined by a colleague of mine at the Hockey News and Yahoo Sports, but he is also an author with a book coming out very soon, On Account of Darkness, Shining Light on Race in Sport. And he is also the founder of the Chatham Kent Sports Network. Is my colleague, Ian Kennedy. Ian, how are you doing today, buddy? Welcome to Avery Sports Show.
Good, Avery. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, of course, of course. Well, I know we talked about you coming on the podcast for a little bit here. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, Ian, just how does it feel to not just be now an author?
What does it mean to tackle some very important issues in sports, especially race, which over the past couple of years have been pushed to the forefront even more so than usual?
Yeah, it's something I've been interested in for a long time. I've always been, I've never loved just writing about the scores and, you know, trades and prospects and things like that. I love that too, because I love hockey, but I've always enjoyed kind of digging deeper and finding those unheard of stories. And my area just happens to be here in Chatham Kent, really rich with all of that. So when the pandemic hit, there were no sports to write about, and it gave me time to kind of, work on this project that I've been toying with for a long time now and put together some of the stories that were so important that I had known about maybe, and maybe some other locals had known about, but that were widely unheard of related to athletes of color, you know, whether it be Black, Indigenous, Japanese, Canadian, which are the three real populations of people that are discussed in the book. But we're the end of or two major terminals on the Underground Railroad right here in Chatham Kent. We have two First Nations communities, and during World War II we had five Japanese internment work camps here. So it's kind of became this area where a lot of people have been through or have settled in, and of course, you know, athletes come out of that. So, and there were a lot of lessons to be learned, and it just felt like the right time to continue that conversation in sport, because like you said, it's been a hot button issue for a while now, but until we actually dig a little deeper into those conversations, I think the surface level is great. You know, we can put out all the statements apologizing for things, right, but if we don't dig deeper into the root of it and see where, you know, it started hundreds of years ago, not yesterday, then we're going to continue this cycle of repeating.
No, of course, I cannot agree more. And one story that you've talked about for quite some time, it's a team that you've been adamant in getting their due out there.
The Chatham Colored All-Stars.
The baseball team who, once again, were passed over for induction
into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame.
And something I did a TikTok on a while ago, and it's a shame, Ian, because you've been so persistent in them getting their due. And once again, they keep on getting passed over. So I applaud you for being on that.
And this is a team with Major League Baseball connections. Ferguson Jenkins Sr., Fergie Jenkins' father, played on this team. And it's a team that has so much importance in baseball history.
Well, why do you think for your end that this team keeps on getting overlooked, even though the contributions to baseball as a whole are incredibly massive?
I've had this on relatively good information that, you know, it is an issue where people don't view that team as being as successful as some of the baseball teams that were out there, because they won, first of all, they were the first all-Black baseball team to ever win a provincial championship in Canada.
Yes.
Which is incredible. And to my knowledge, still the only all-Black baseball team. I know there was a few in Manitoba that won the semi-professional leagues that they had there. But this is like the first and only league that, or team that's done that. But why they're getting passed over is just a lack of understanding. I think because you can say, yes, they weren't as good as some of the professional or semi-professional teams in Canada at that time, but also those teams didn't have to deal with segregation and people spitting on them or throwing rocks at them and having parents to encourage kids to do that at games and not being able to stay in hotels when they're going on the road and not being welcomed into restaurants. It was the barriers of that existed for that team to reach the level they did and with the athletes they did is incredible. And I mean, like you said, Fergie Jenkins, so his father was on the team in the 1930s, and Fergie became the first ever Canadian inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. He's going to get a statue in May here outside of Wrigley Field. So he's just a monumental member of the baseball community. So I think that people need to look at that team as A, being a team that won a provincial championship with no one else had done, and B, look at the legacy, the impact that they had culturally and societally, not just as what they achieved in those years in the 1930s, but Fergie Jenkins, another member of that team, Wilfred Boomer Harding, was the first ever black man to play professional hockey in the International Hockey League, the first ever black man to skate at Detroit's Olympia Stadium, which was the home of the Detroit Red Wings for 50 years. They had Earl Flatt Chase, who was the first ever black man to play for the London Majors, which is a notable, Canadian baseball franchise that has
Yes.
featured many pros both before the majors and after the majors. So they were filled with success. But if I was really speaking honestly with you, I would ask you to look at the panel that's perhaps making the judgment, and it's not a diverse group. I don't think they have the understanding of what the barriers were. And I guess that's just why, and I don't want to be too hard on them, but I do want them to know that the need for education is there. They should broaden that horizon of what it means to be a successful team in history. And I think if they were able to talk to people within the local black community, within baseball, when we talk about other leagues where, that were predominantly black at the time, I think they would be able to see that that team is very worthy.
Wow, that's a great explanation. And you know what?
I enjoy the honesty and I enjoy the rawness.
Because there are so many sporting leagues and so many sporting bodies where the voters for Hall of Fame, you're right, are not diverse. They are lacking people of color. They're lacking women. And to be quite honest, they are mainly straight white men who don't understand these types of stories. So I appreciate you be also being that. It's true. It happens in literally hockey, baseball, basketball, three sports around this our continent, Ian.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem right from the bottom up. I mean, look at coaching, look at the managerial staffs of just about any professional team, and it's lacking through any pro sport. And I don't think people even understand. They look at baseball now or basketball now, and they see diversity there, but they don't realize that basketball, the NBA was an all-white league forever. Major League Baseball was an all-white league that fought it tooth and nail forever, and the NHL is still in that fight. So it's there, it's prevalent, and to ignore that, the truth and the past of that is why we still see a team that's so deserving being shunned from the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame, and it's why we still see these issues of racism persisting in sport.
It's true. And you mentioned, I know you did a piece for Hockey Museum. You mentioned how things need to change. You did an article where you featured
20 women who needed to be considered for coaching roles and front office roles in the game of hockey.
And it was a great piece, Ian. But what wasn't shocking to me was the pushback you got from that. Looking in the comment section on the Hockey News on Facebook, anytime either one of us touches, an issue on race, sexism, gender equality, the comments, to be quite frank, are a cesspool. And seeing the pushback right there showed that yes, we need to push narrative until it's no longer an issue because people still think that it's a bad thing or that there is no need to have women in the front office, to have black people involved in coaching roles in hockey. So when people tell me hockey is for everyone, I mean, the idea, yes, the idea, it should be for everybody, but really, in reality,
There are still so many barriers that say, hey.
this game isn't for you. We don't want it to.
Yeah, it's that is a such a tough thing. I actually did a seminar with the San Jose Sharks earlier this month, and I titled it "Hockey is Not for Everyone." and kind of challenged their organization on a few things. But it was really productive. As you said, the comments, predominantly say things like, well, she doesn't have enough experience, or she's never worked in the NHL. And I think there, I don't know if it's just that, if it is that sexism, right, where men think that only men can understand hockey, which of course is a falsity, but you don't, like, gender does not describe who can understand the, see the game the best, or explain or teach the game the best, or draw X's and O's, or evaluate skill, like skating skills and puck skills. Like, that has nothing to do with. So to say that, a woman that is a five-time Olympian is less qualified than a fourth line NHL player, or a first line NHL player, or a, it's ridiculous. There's no basing in that someone's understanding of the game of hockey, because there's not full-on body checking. Like, that's the only component that's a real difference. And I'm telling you, if we could teach men how to appropriately angle and use their body contact and separate pucks from players like women's hockey players do, you'd have a far more effective defensive system in the National Hockey League with a lot of teams than these young guys that are out in the trying to make their name in hockey, just running around. I think it's just a glorification of that, the protection of keeping spaces away from other people. And it goes across gender and race and things like that, where people are afraid that they're going to lose their spot. Well, it's not the case. And all it's doing is keeping some very talented women or BIPOC individuals out of sport that could actually change this game for the better. So that piece, I did one on general managers. I've been working on one about filling the coaching roles that are in the NHL. And I know what the result's going to be from that as well. It's just unfortunate, because there are so many 400 win NCAA coaches out there that are women, that are have decades of experience, that don't get looked at, when the best qualification for half of the guys in the NHL right now is how many teams they've been fired from. So I don't get that. If that's the marker of success, the fact that you've been there for 15 years and been fired from three different teams, well, we're looking at the game all wrong.
No, I agree. It is very strange how it's funny how sports in general, where you're right, you can be fired from three, four, five teams, or lead a team to consistent sub 500 records, and you still find a job elsewhere. But you're right, you can be a successful coach in Europe or juniors or women's hockey, and you don't get a sniff. I mean, great example is Rikard Gronberg,
who has had success at various levels of European hockey, and you still don't hear his name as a serious candidate for a head coaching job. And there's still this stigma of, what can a European head coach do in the NHL?
The NHL has been around, I've said before, the NHL has been around for 105 seasons, and we have only had two European-born and trained head coaches in 105 years. That's very embarrassing in my mind, Ian.
Well, I mean, if you look at the percentage of European players that are in the NHL, you would assume that we would have an equal percentage of European coaches in the NHL, and it's just not the case. So, yeah, there definitely is that nationalism, or perhaps at times kind of almost like a xenophobic underlying of being afraid of. I mean, to me, in a business standpoint or a working standpoint, if you can speak multiple languages and communicate in various ways to people in
Yes.
my organization, that's fabulous, especially when we're talking about an international league with stars from all over the world. And having that experience working with players from different parts of the world, if anything, and seeing different styles of play at the international level, in European leagues, and seeing those players go on, and knowing what makes a successful NHLer from your programs, those are all win-win situations in my mind. So not giving a sniff to a person like that, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But that's where the NHL is at right now, and until someone like him, bursts through the door and has a winning season, unfortunately, it kind of takes that groundbreaker to change minds, and we haven't, unfortunately, had that yet.
No, of course. I couldn't agree with you more on that, Ian. I know with your book On Account of Darkness, I know at times it's a very tough topic to get into, but is there one story you want people to really say, wow, I didn't know about that, or I didn't know enough about that story or that player or that event in your mind in the book here?
Well, I mean, the title of On Account of Darkness, first of all, comes from that 1934 Chatham Colored All-Stars baseball team. They were one out away from winning the provincial championship. They're up 3-2. And the referees called the game On Account of Darkness. And it was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a summer day, and early fall day. And, you know, talking to the descendants of that team and reading the interviews following it, most of them say, you know, most of the descendants will say that the only reason that the game was called On Account of Darkness, the only reason it was too dark on the field, was because there was 9 black players on the field. So that's the title comes from that. And I think that people knowing that story will really help. But, you know, I've had some pre-readers look at it from the United States and things like that. And not even having no knowledge of residential schools in Canada or the role that hockey played at residential schools as a tool of assimilation. You know, hockey's always been seen as the quintessential Canadian game. So introducing it into residential schools was purposefully to make Indigenous youth feel more Canadian and to use it as a tool of discipline, where if the kids didn't behave, they didn't get to play hockey anymore. So, hockey has been used in a variety of ways, but there's so many. I don't think anyone's going to open the book and read it and think, I knew that, and I knew that about every story in there, because, you know, we have everything from the famous Canadian bass fisherman, Bob Izumi, whose dad was in a Japanese internment camp, founded the first ever bass fishing tournament in Canada. And Bob's now an international television, radio author. You know, he's a star of everything. Vicky Sunahara, who was the, you know, 2-time Olympic gold medalist for Canada, 5-time world or 7-time world champion. Her dad was in a Japanese internment camp. And just, you know, they all seem to just happen to settle in a little town called Chatham, Kent, Ontario. You know, everybody's a lot of the Japanese internment people that came through those camps settled here because they were forced to work in farms afterwards. That was the only job that would welcome them. But I don't know. The stories are so many. They're so vast. And seeing the role that sport played in upholding systems of oppression, of fostering racism, and also the role that sport played in helping some people transcend the barriers that might have been there, because it, you know, there was always an idea that if you were talented enough, some people would break the rules for you. And so it's just this really, you know, interwoven story of the good and the bad of sport. But yeah, as for the stories, I love the Boomer Harding story of, you know, him breaking those barriers into professional hockey, which he did in 1946. So, you know, more than a decade before Willie O'Ree actually broke the barrier into the NHL for black men. And there's another player named George Chin, a Chinese Canadian athlete who, hockey player, tried out for the Maple Leafs in 1944. Didn't make it, even though he was lighting up their training camp, and went back to his team and scored, I think, 6 goals the first game and 12 the next after he got cut. But went on to start the University of Michigan. But, you know, fabulous hockey player. And I think the saddest part of his story, perhaps, is that he didn't get to make the Toronto Maple Leafs, but it was the Chin family in a little village called Lucknow, Ontario, that taught another great Canadian hockey player how to play the game. And that was Paul Henderson. So the Chins gave Paul Henderson his first set of hockey equipment. Paul learned how to play the game on the frozen basement floor of the Chins restaurant. And the Chin family coached him all the way through. And of course, Henderson goes on to play for the Toronto Maple Leafs, become an NHL All-Star, and famously score that 1972 Summit Series goal that is the most famous Canadian hockey goal in history. And it was because of a family that was oppressed to a point where their stars couldn't make the NHL. So many stories. I just, you know, I could talk about them all day. So if you want another example, I've got 15 more, but that's a tough question to answer when I feel like I've been riding right there beside all of these these people and talking to all their families. And I just feel like I know every quote unquote character in the book, even though they're all real people. But I love them all, and I couldn't tell you which one's better than the other. So.
Wow, that's amazing. And I think a great point that you're booking is that you're showing that the time growing up, I remember that history of sports in Canada for a very long time was portrayed as being very white culture. With your book, you're showing that, hey, the history of the sport in Canada is very diverse. We've had sporting heroes who you may or may not have heard of who were Black, who were Japanese, who are Chinese. You know, Canada sports history at times can be very white-facing. So the fact that you have stories about this on Black athletes who are Canadian.
The fact that you have stories on Black athletes, Asian Canadian culture and sports in this country, it's great to see more diverse stories of Canada's sporting history.
Of course, Indigenous people were here long before us, and yes. the history there is of the original versions of games, you know, lacrosse being the main one mm-hmm. that gets featured there. And how it kind of turned into a Canadian thing as well. Canada's a national sport, you know, the summer national sport, which is about as big of an appropriation swing as we can take at something. But the fact that, you know, people of color from whatever background have played such an integral role in sport in Canada, not just in being there in representation, but in breaking barriers. My personal favorite story from the book, stepping back a minute there, is a story of a man named Rolly Miles, who was a Canadian Football Hall of Famer that played in Edmonton. And Rolly's American, but he came to Edmonton actually to play professional baseball, and then became one of the first ever Black men in the Canadian Football League. And he visited my hometown of Wallaceburg, Ontario, which is in Chatham, Kent here, and spoke to a group of white service club members and leaders in the community. And at that point, Wallaceburg had a sundown town rule, which meant that, you know, Black people couldn't be in town after dark. And Rolly got up to the microphone, looked at a room of 200 white men and said, I don't know if you've brought me here just to sign your autographs or to feel good, but I know that my even being here is breaking the law. So if you're not willing to change the law, I'm going home. And they took him over to the city hall. They looked through all the books, couldn't find anything on written down on record. But of course, that's not the way sundown town rules worked. They were enforced by the citizens and by realtors and things like that. And sure enough, within 18 months of that speech, the first ever Black family moved into Wallaceburg, Ontario. And within 24 hours of Rolly Miles forcing that conversation to happen, the mayor of that town, for the first time ever, went into the press and said, this town is welcoming for everyone, no matter who you are, what your color is, what your race is, what your ethnicity, background, religion. And it opened the town. And so seeing people like that come in and make significant change in not just sport, but in our society is so impactful. And I hope that people, when they read it, look at that and say, you know, it's always existed. It still exists. And but if we understand the historical background and the roots of the racism that we see in sport, we can actually plan a path forward.
Wow. That's amazing, Ian. And, you know, being an Edmontonian, I had heard a lot about Rolly Miles and his career and his life. And that's one story that I never heard before.
Amazing. It's a great point. I think your book is going to open up a lot of eyes. It's going to be people think about, you know, yes, we are sports fans, but we need to learn about our history more and, you know, realize that as much as we are hockey fans, baseball fans, lacrosse fans, whatever, the history of these sports isn't all sunshine and roses. And it's good to learn about where our sports have come from and where we've come from and how we can make these sports better for the present and in the future. For all, no matter, like you said, no matter your national origin, your gender, your race, your creed.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I don't want people to also look at the book and think, you know, I know that people are going to look at the title and be like, oh, here we go again. You know, we're going to hear about how awful the whole world is.
Right.
And, you know, I guess one of the other questions, which I always like to address, is that I'm a white person writing this book. And so I always like to address that because, you know, it does raise the question, but I approached it from the fact that as a story preservationist, you know, I saw these stories kind of disappearing in my area. I hadn't heard about them. I grew up 10 minutes from Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is, you know, one of the most famous stops in the Underground Railroad. And I never visited until I was in my 30s. It just wasn't a topic that anyone had heard of. So the book is filled with celebrating Black and Indigenous and Japanese Canadians and Chinese Canadians as well. It's not just this negative history, although the negative history is, of course, needs to be talked about. It's there. But I really wanted to just approach it as the, you know, like I said, keeping stories alive, and because I can maybe hold space or open a door and hold the door open so that the conversation can continue using the privilege that I have. But it's, it was really important to me, and growing up here and living with so many wonderful people from the Black community in Chatham Kent and our Indigenous community, they said, you know, do this, please. Like, it wasn't, it never was something I intended on, you know, writing a book on racism as a white person. But it just, once I started learning from these people and with these people, everyone was like, please put it down. Our stories are going away. We don't even have records of half of this stuff. So I was excited to be able to document it, not tell the stories so much, but just preserve the stories that were that people need to know.
I appreciate that. You know, that's a great example of you being a great ally. That's something I wrote about for hockey news, that, you know, to move forward in hockey sports, we need our allies to step up and have our back. So I appreciate you doing that, Ian. And it's a really great point to mention, because there are so many stories in sports in this country involving people of color. You know, they're not being preserved, or they've been lost over time. So the fact that you're helping these stories come to life to the book, I guarantee you, there will be people across the country, I'm sure across the world, who will say, wow, I didn't know that about Chatham Kent. I didn't know this about this player or that player. Because I'm sure a lot of people didn't know those stories about someone like a Paul Henderson. I'm sure they didn't know about his background. You're opening up a lot of eyes. I'm sure you will be with this book, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, that's the goal. I hope it, you know, I've never entered this thinking, oh, I'm going to get rich by writing a book, because it's not going to happen. You know, it's, But if, as I had with the San Jose Sharks, you know, if the conversation can be opened through the book, and if more people are just willing to sit down and hear a story and then think about why that story happened, you know, because the history is there. Why are there not as many Black people playing hockey? Well, Black people weren't allowed to skate at arenas. I mean, it's not a... It doesn't take rocket science to figure out that there's stereotypes about Black people and swimming. Well, Black people couldn't go to public pools or beaches. Yeah. So if I don't know how to do something, I can't teach my kids to do it, and they can't teach their kids to do it. So the legacy is built right into our systems. It's built right into segregation and racism and the oppression of people of color in all ways, shapes, and forms. So it's not like, you know, somebody's just not good at a sport. That's not the way this works. It's decades of holding people back and getting over that generational trauma and generational oppression but I just want that conversation to happen. You know, like, I know that we have the exact same mindset of trying to make this. We love hockey. That's why we write about it all the time.
Of course.
You know, I want to love hockey that looks like the places I live, you know, and looks like the people I know and the people I care about. And that means seeing, you know, more BIPOC individuals in hockey. It means seeing more women in hockey. You know, I want the trans community and the LGBTQ+ community just to thrive in hockey and feel safe. And it's, but we can't get there without closing our mouths and going the same way that we've always done. So,
Ian, thank you for doing the podcast, buddy. I enjoyed our conversation. It was a much needed chat, and hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Thanks so much for having me, Avery. You're doing wonderful stuff in sports and in general, and I love the podcast, so I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, buddy. Anytime for you, Ian, bud.